That's okay. They can not stream this part. The first workshop session of the San Miguel Island Abalone Fishery Advisory Group. And I'm John Ugaretz. I am the California Department of Fish and Game's Marine Region Nearshore Ecosystem Coordinator, responsible for nearshore resources statewide, and managing processes like these and other nearshore fishery processes. The purpose of today's meeting is to first review the results of the August 2006 Abalone Snapshot Survey that was conducted at San Miguel Island as a cooperative effort between department divers, other agencies, commercial fishermen, and recreational divers. We want to then look at the data that were collected at the survey and discuss their potential interpretation with regards to the viability of an abalone fishery at San Miguel Island, and also to begin discussions of potential management options and tools that can be applied to the fishery if one is instituted. And that's a big point that for those of you who are in the public and who are here out of other interest, it's important to note that the Fish and Game Commission has directed the department to undergo this process to consider management options for a potential fishery, not necessarily to consider whether a fishery should occur or if a fishery will occur. That is for the commission to decide at a later date after this process. And finally, we will be conducting a brief abalone advisory group meeting tomorrow morning to deal with some of the business of the group itself. You have agendas at the front of the room there. There should be plenty of them. There are a few revisions that I wanted to just walk through quickly. We did finally get our room assignment. The main auditorium will be this room. We're starting here this evening. I will go through a very brief overview of the Abalone Fishery Advisory Group process. Then Christine Barsky, one of our department senior specialists who works on invertebrates, will talk about abalone life history, population status, and the history of the fishery in California. Then Pat Colston, our manager in charge of resource assessment for the marine region, will talk about the survey itself. And then we're going to have two of our guest panelist speakers, Dr. Jeremy Prince and Dr. Chris DeWeese, who will talk to you about their views of abalone fisheries, potential fishery options worldwide, different views, and some interesting discussion there. We then should have time to have a sort of panel discussion with the people who have made presentations and you in the audience this evening, though I would point out that the primary time for the real working group discussions will be tomorrow. Today is more about learning and about discussing what's occurred to date, and then tomorrow we'll get into the nuts and bolts. We'll adjourn for the evening about 9 tonight. Tomorrow morning, the Abalone Advisory Group working meeting will be held in the Bren School third floor Pine Room. It's up the elevator and the first door on the, what did she tell me, left? Anyway, up the elevator and near the elevator in this Bren School building. That will run from 8 to 8:30. We will very briefly review the agenda and any outcomes and discussion from tonight, and then go right into concurrent working groups at about 9 a.m. The concurrent working groups are going to be next door at Marine Science Institute on the third and fourth floors tomorrow. Okay, so that's starting at 9 if you're coming just for the working group sessions. We have three rooms set aside. The intent is to have just three sessions talking about the same thing in each session, and we will reconvene at 10:30 in this room again to report back what was discussed so everybody can hear what the other working groups were talking about. We'll break for lunch at about 11:30, and for AAG members and our invited participants, we have a lunch that we'll discuss tomorrow, what the logistics are for that. The biggest change to agenda is that Señor Rodriguez was not able to make it out of Mexico through things we couldn't control, so he will not be joining us, unfortunately, today or tomorrow. And we hope to have him at a future AAG meeting to discuss some of what's going on in Mexico. So we've taken that off the agenda. We'll reconvene after lunch in the breakout groups at MSI at 12:30 tomorrow. and then come back to this room at 2 p.m. again to report back and discuss what's happened, and then have a good roundtable discussion about where we go next in the AAG process and with potential options for management as we go through this process. So that's the agenda, and I'm going to jump from that right into the next part of the presentation, which is an overview of the Abalone Fishery Advisory Group. To start with, this group was instituted because of the California Fish and Game Commission's adoption of what's known as an Abalone Recovery and Management Plan. And this plan is a document that details recovery strategies for the southern portion of California abalone stocks and management strategies for the existing North Coast recreational fishery. As a part of the adoption process, the commission included what was then known as Alternative 8, which allows consideration of a limited red abalone fishery at San Miguel Island prior to full recovery in the southern range. And the commission, in making that adoption, directed the Department of Fish and Game to work with the California Abalone Association to gather data, primarily, and to determine fishery options. It's important, again, to note, and I know I just said this, but I'll say it again, that the consideration of whether or not a fishery will actually begin is up to the commission and will occur after the AAG discussions and deliberations. When we started discussing how to implement the plan in the South Coast and how to follow the commission's direction, we started thinking about stakeholder involvement in a relatively short-term effort to develop these potential fishery alternatives. And we wanted to be sure that stakeholder participation would include joint resource surveys, discussions of allowable catch and allocation between commercial and recreational take if there is a fishery, and recommendations on potential options to manage a small fishery. There's a lot of great ideas out there. The department has some ideas. The abalone divers who used to dive at San Miguel Island have some ideas, and other people have ideas. And we want to hear all of those ideas, discuss them, discuss how they would work if a fishery is established. And to do that, we decided to bring together an abalone fishery advisory group. Their role is to provide recommendations to the Department of Fish and Game, and their recommendations need to be considered in the context of the department and commission roles as resource managers. The AAG doesn't make decisions about whether to have fisheries or how to manage fisheries. They make recommendations to the management entities. We expect the group to develop a reasonable range of alternatives to achieve the goals of the ARMP, including what's adopted by the commission in the form of Alternative 8. And that reasonable range is important because we're not necessarily expecting the group to reach consensus on something. We want them to provide options, and that's an important part of their process. The advisory group is a voluntary group that's appointed by the director of the Department of Fish and Game. They're not paid for their time are doing this out of their interest for California resources and fisheries. Their charge is specifically to provide recommendations on four items: a potential total allowable catch for red abalone at San Miguel Island, alternatives for allocation between commercial and recreational take if a fishery is established, alternative regulations to achieve the total allowable catch and allocation, and potential management, enforcement, and monitoring techniques. It's a fairly specific charge. And as we've noted in the agenda, we're just beginning these discussions today and tomorrow. We also do allow for the group to talk about other items that are brought up either by the group or by outside folks if time allows, but that's secondary to their primary role. The group is active through July of 2007, though in establishing them, we did include an option to continue if we felt more time was necessary. It includes representatives from commercial fishing interests, recreational divers, fishery scientists, government agencies, and conservation and non-consumptive use representatives. Nominations to the group were from the public, and they were considered by the Fish and Game Commission. This is fairly unique in an advisory role to the department, but we asked the commission specifically for their advice on the nominations and their approval of the department recommendations. And the appointments, as I noted, are made by the department director. And that's what brought us here. And now what we'd like to talk about a little bit is Ms. Barsky discussing abalone in general and some of the details that are important to understand when you talk about an abalone fishery. Christine.
It's the one that says history. He put it in the folder. It's titled, the OP. Oh, wait a minute, Abalone Advisory Committee meeting.
There we go.
There I am.
The only one in there.
The only one in there. Okay. Good evening. I was asked to give you a brief history of the abalone fishery in California. I'm a little intimidated since we have a large number of fishermen who participated in the fishery and all the North Coast fish and game biologists who are experts on the topic, but I will do my best. As many of you might know, the California fishery for abalone originated with the Indian people who lived in the coastal areas and in the Channel Islands, and we know this from middens and shell piles that we find along the coast. And they used them for barter, for decoration, and for food. And they did this while the otters were inhabiting the whole coast of Southern California. And however, by the 1850s, however, the fur traders had virtually eliminated otters along the coast, so the abalone populations expanded, and this probably contributed to the development of commercial fisheries in the state of California. Down arrow. Okay. On the computer. Okay. There's computers all over here. Okay. California has roughly 1,100 miles of coastline, and abalone distribution varies in California primarily due to temperature. Blacks are intertidal species that are generally found statewide. The green, pink, and white abalone are primarily found in the Southern California region, which is that blue box that extends from Point Conception south. The greens are shallower than the pinks, and the pinks are shallower than the whites, which are the species that inhabits the deepest depths. We also have pintos, and which are now synonymous with the threaded abalone and the flat abalone, and they're predominantly found north of Conception in low numbers, but they also are found in the Southern California region occasionally. Red abalone is the one we're all interested in at this point. It's the it has been the mainstay of the fishery, both commercial and recreational, and it's found statewide, but in the Southern California region, mostly in restricted to areas with cold upwelling waters. There is currently a moratorium on the take of all abalone south of a line drawn through the center of the mouth of San Francisco Bay, which is that green box up there. So south of that, there is no commercial or recreational take of abalone. And that includes the Farallon Islands and the 8 Southern Channel Islands. The recreational fishery for red abalone takes place on the Northern California coast, where you see the green box. It is a free diving and shore picking fishery only. We require a sport fishing license and an abalone punch card. You're limited to 24 abalone per year and 3 in possession per day. And foraging sea otters in the Central Coast, which is indicated by the violet there, have essentially eliminated harvestable quantities of red abalone. The history of the California abalone fishery points to the need for defined recovery and management guidelines. At one time, five species of abalone, the red, black, green, and white, supported recreational and commercial fisheries in California. However, by 1997, Central and Southern California abalones had experienced stock collapse due to both natural and human-related causes, resulting in the closing of all these areas to abalone fishing. Management authority for the commercial abalone fishery was only recently transferred to the Fish and Game Commission from the legislature, and the abalone recovery and management plan was an important component of this transfer. The five formerly fished species of abalone in the Central and Southern California region are still at risk of further population declines, and in one case, extinction. The white abalone has been listed as an endangered species under the Endangered Species Act, and the black abalone is also a candidate for fishing, for listing. And I was told history, so you get some history. So the Chinese fishermen arrived with the discovery of gold in California, and they had enjoyed abalone in their homeland, and so they were delighted to find a bounty of abalone on our coast. They only harvested between the high and low tides, generally either by prying the abalones off the rocks with handheld instruments or by using small skiffs and wooden poles to knock and then pluck the abalones out of the water. The product was dried on our coastline out in the open, and it was shipped to China. The fishery began to decline at the end of that century because coastal counties became very alarmed by the large harvest of abalones, and there were localized depletions. So a lot of these local governments passed laws prohibiting the harvesting of abalone in shallow areas, and so essentially they were put out of business. The Japanese immigrants replaced the Chinese, and they introduced diving to exploit the virgin subtidal populations of abalone, first as free divers using sake barrels empty as floats, and then using hard hat gear. And hard hat gear was they brought the equipment from Japan, and it was a closely guarded secret. And it wasn't till the 1930s, until some Caucasian divers figured out how to use the equipment. At the beginning of the period, the first size limit was put on abalone, all species, and it was 15 inches around the perimeter of the shell. And there's probably some problems measuring that, but that's what it was for all species. Seasons were introduced, and there was also laws prohibiting export of the meat and shells. However, a restaurateur in Monterey developed or perfected cooking the abalone steak, and so the demand for the meat from the abalone continued to grow. They also used hand pumps to supply the air to these divers, and in the 20s, they switched over to mechanical air compressors, which made it a lot more efficient. You were able to get crew members a lot more easily, and so the fishery continued to expand up until World War II, when most of the Japanese were interned in camps inland. In 1954, commercial gear was mandated for the commercial fishery. It was a surface-applied air pump, 100 feet of hose, to collecting baskets and a measuring device. Then in 1955, we got our first commercial size limits, where you measured the abalone along the longest shell diameter rather than the perimeter of the animal. Also in the 1950s, areas in Central and Southern California and all the islands that had previously been closed were opened up to abalone harvesting. In 1959, the 7 3/4-inch size limit for the red abalone went into effect, and it remained at that size until the closure of the fishery. The 60s were a good decade for the abalone industry. Each year, except in 1969, there were landings of over 4 million pounds of all abalone species combined. The annual harvest was primarily reds and pinks, with the reds providing the most poundage. However, during this period, the landings in Morro Bay steadily declined from over 1 million pounds to 200,000 pounds, and that was because of the arrival of otters, which dined on the abalones voraciously. Two major technological changes also occurred. Local divers figured out how to use a scuba second stage on the end of the commercial hose, so they didn't have to wear heavy hats or masks. They could actually use a scuba regulator at the end of their hose. And also we had the development by local Santa Rosa family of the Radden and then the Wilson boats, which were designed specifically for high speed and to handle the pounding in the channel. So that allowed fishermen to make the trip back and forth to the islands rather quickly. Also, scuba and wetsuits became readily available to the recreational diver. And so they started harvesting abalones. And we also had the establishment of the charter commercial passenger fishing vessel or the dive charter boat, which gave these recreational divers access to the more remote areas and the islands. In the 70s, we finally got an abalone permit, and it was a $100 permit, and it was required for all persons taking abalone. The following year, the export of abalone was again allowed. And in 1977, a section of the mainland in L.A. County from Palos Verdes Point to Dana Point was closed due to the dwindling stocks of abalones there. And that closure is still in effect, and the abalones in that area have never recovered. In order to purchase an abalone permit starting in 1997, you had to have had an abalone permit in the previous year. And if you didn't, you weren't allowed to participate in the fishery. So this was the first restrictions on the fishery. And additional 5% of the total number of permits was allowed in a lottery. Landing requirements were also introduced, and also an examination process to become a diver. When you look at all the landings of abalone, all species combined statewide, the landings appeared to be relatively stable in the 50s and the 60s. But this was actually an illusion. When the individual abalone fisheries are divided into components, you see a pattern of serial decline by species and by area. What's on the picture right now is red abalone landings broken into geographical areas by these series of graphs. And the graphs illustrate a spatial trend from higher catches coming from the mainland and the nearshore islands shifting over time to the more remote areas. So Central California and Southern California mainland, they're at the top, and then you've got Miguel and Nicholas down bottom, and you can see how the fishery moved. But when you lumped everything together, all species together, these kinds of things did not become clear to us. In the 1980s, in addition to fishery pressures, nature dealt the abalone resource two heavy blows. There was a major El Nino event in 82-83, and the warm water weakened the kelp, and then we had severe storms that tore up the kelp beds. And since kelp is the primary food for abalone, that was not good for the resource. Also, withering foot syndrome emerged. It's a bacterium that was first described in 1986 that affects the gut of the abalone, and it actually causes them to consume their own foot. So the foot gets withered, and you can see in that picture of the abalone on the, I guess it's your right side, that it's fairly shriveled, and they usually dropped off the rocks and were eaten by predators, or they simply starved to death. The black abalones in particular were hard hit by withering foot syndrome, WFS. Although it has affected other species, they took the brunt of it probably because they were in great quantity and close proximity in the shallows. This is a graph from some of our historical records of the numbers of abalone permits from 59 through 97. And what you need to know is that the highs in the second half of the 1960s, those violet highs, were partly because abalone permits were free and there was no distinction made between a diver or a crew member. So the reason why it's so high is because you had both individuals there. And a number of people applied for the permit, and then once they tried the physically demanding work of either being a tender or diving, they gave it up quickly. In 72-73 season, an abalone crew license was initiated, so that's where you start seeing the yellow bars are crew permits. They were $100, and the diver permits two seasons later were raised to $200. In 1985, legislation mandated a reduction in permits, and they did it multiple times. We finally got to 1985 where they wanted a reduction in permits to 100 by attrition, and by the time the fishery was closed in 97, they got to that point. In the 1990s, the three big events were abalone permits could be transferred on a two-for-one basis, and that was the first time abalone permits could be transferred. In 1994, the harvest of black abalones was banned primarily because of the small number of black abalone that survived. Sure. Two-for-one meant that if you had to buy two existing abalone permits, turn them into the department, and then we issued you one in return. And there were people that bought these, you know, went out and bought two permits, even though at that point things were looking not too good for the resource. Finally, in 1997, the ban of the commercial harvest of all species of abalone and the closure of the fishery in Southern California took place. In summary, I just wanted to go over the factors, and there are a great many, contributing to the management failure in the commercial abalone fishery. There are a number of factors, but one of the prime ones was reliance on size limits. And size limits focus on spawning potential, but they ignore the effects of recruitment failure, especially under intense fishing. And it also doesn't address the loss of adult aggregations of animals. And since abalone are broadcast breeders, if you don't have a lot of neighbors, you don't have spawning success. Also, there was reliance on the fishery-dependent catch per unit of effort. And there actually were other things going on, like the increased use of LORAN and GPS, more faster boats, better technology. So the CPUE remained high, even though the numbers of abalone were actually dwindling. Also, you had a lot of fishermen that were now participating in dual fisheries, the urchin and the abalone fishery. So when they were spending a lot of time on the grounds, they could be scouting for both species. So they actually were spending more time that didn't get reflected, so it looked like the catch per unit effort was still remaining high. There was also the problem of increasing product value. So as the landings declined, the value increased exponentially, and there were also demands from foreign markets and other individuals to keep the fishery open, and the increases in the value of the product just increased political pressure to continue fishing despite evidence of collapsing stocks. Another problem was management had no way to deal with things like sea otters, whose range is extending slowly, but in both directions along the coast, and pollution, disease, El Nino effects. All these factors contributed to population declines, but they weren't something that management can control. Poaching is also a serious problem because it's lucrative, it's highly organized, and the department's warden force is often too small and too spread out to eliminate it. So the degree of each of these factors, their impact on the various species in the area may vary, but they all contributed to the decline of the fishery. And that's all I have to say on the history of abalone.
Thank you, Christine, and you got us almost right back on schedule. And if people have questions, please save them. We're going to have a bit of a discussion once all the presentations are given. So now we have Mr. Colston here. I don't know, Steve, can we get less light in front for the slides? If possible. Which one's you? So now Pat Colston will take us from the history to as far as we know from August where we are now.
Thanks. I was asked to give a very brief overview of the survey we conducted in August of this year, and it will be brief, and I encourage you to take a look at the encourage you to look at the FTP site for the project, where we have posted a couple weeks ago a report and some appendices that describe what we did out there in much more detail. Don't have time for a lot of detail today, so take a look at those things. Let's see. So what I'm doing today is basically a snapshot of the snapshot, if you will. And my co-authors are Ian Taniguchi and Derek Stein. Ian was probably the person that should give this talk, but he's on vacation this week, and Derek's here. Derek was in charge of logistics pretty much for the project, and Ian was the biologist in charge, and I was kind of the overall coordinator for the project. And we have contributions in our reports and to this presentation from Dr. Jim Moore and Dr. Laura Rogers Bennett. Laura's here tonight, and will be here tomorrow. They took a look at the health of the abalone that a few of them we collected out there during the week. So that's what we're looking at today. John talked about the abalone recovery and management plan. One of the things that the plan says about this fishery consideration process is that it should be supported by sound science. And we didn't have a lot of information on the abalone resource at San Miguel Island. And so we realized right away that we needed to go out there and get some more information, and that was the overall purpose of the project. Any project of this magnitude has safety as its primary concern. The conditions were tough out there, and we brought everybody home, so we did okay there. But we wanted to document red abalone density around the island, their distribution, their size frequency, and put ourselves in a position to calculate total abundance for the purposes of setting total allowable catch levels. And one of the premises of the ARMP was that there was reserves in place already at San Miguel Island that could provide a refuge for the population if our fisheries management didn't work out. So we wanted to document the populations, particularly in the Judith Rock Reserve that's out there on the southwest side of the island. The other reserve that's out there, Harris Point, doesn't have a lot of abalone habitat, so we didn't actually sample there. We don't expect there's a lot of abalone there, but certainly the Judith Rock Reserve could. Some secondary objectives were to look at the other species of abalone that are out there, document habitat conditions, and by the way, we haven't really analyzed the habitat data. That's next on our list of things to do. We wanted to examine the health of the abalone there, particularly with regard to this withering syndrome and their reproductive capability. And actually, a fairly significant part of this effort was to, you know, what I call here test drive some collaborations. And one of the reasons we tried to fit this thing into a single week with lots of folks out there working together was we wanted to see if we could do a good collaborative effort of this kind and do some good training of people, get some people besides fish and game folks involved. We coordinated closely in the planning of this thing with the California Abalone Association and a number of other groups to get this done. So that was another objective of this thing. Most of you probably know where San Miguel Island is, but quickly, it's the westernmost of the northern Channel Islands out there towards Point Conception, about 40 nautical miles southwest of Santa Barbara. It's a moderately sized island. It's 14 square miles. My understanding is that it's owned by the U.S. Navy, but it's managed by the Channel Islands National Park. It's kind of a low, sandy island compared to some of the other islands. And it's, like I said, it's very exposed out there to wind and currents and so forth, and is surrounded by relatively cold water compared to the other islands. And just a quick point here, I got this slide from Gary Davis at the Channel Islands National Park. It just shows how San Miguel Island's out there facing these northern currents that bring cold water down. And this figure shows the California countercurrent, which brings warmer water up from the south, mixes it in that area. And there's really quite a difference in the water temperatures around these various islands. And the fact that San Miguel is cold may explain why the red abalone have persisted out there pretty well. Just a little it's a little bit of information here about some of the zones and things that we used for the survey. We divided the island into four zones for the purposes of our survey. We used kelp coverage as a surrogate for abalone habitat in designing our study, setting up stations. I'm going to give you a quick tour of the island here. I'm all screwed up now. Bear with me here for a second. I got to avoid that button from now on. Sorry about that. Anyway, kind of starting at the northeast side of the island, this is the Kyler Harbor area with Prince Island. This is part of the area that we did not sample in the northeast zone because of the limited amount of kelp habitat that's there. This is that Cardwell Point area on the eastern point of the island where there's a kind of a sandy spit there. This is the Crook Point area in the south part of the island, southeast. This is the Tyler Bight area. I'll be mentioning these areas later in some of the figures or the results. And so this is the Tyler Bight area, kind of in the southwest area. And this is the Castle Rock area on the exposed northwest side of the island. We were only able to get out there one day. It's pretty tough out there. Lots of wind, lots of waves. And there is a lot of kelp, though, so we went out and looked. And again, lead biologist for the study was Ian Taniguchi, and Derek was our logistics person, coordinator. We had a dive safety officer involved, David Osorio, and a few things here about the survey in general. We had 57 divers out there for about 4.5 days from 9 a.m. Sunday to 11 a.m. on Thursday, roughly. Had about 10 vessels out there. Weather was a big factor in our survey. It controlled what we did each day, where we went, and all that sort of thing. And we had like 36 hours of 40-knot winds out there, so it made things tough. And this forced us to have a lot of a dynamic situation out there with lots of strategy sessions to talk about what to do and where to do it. And again, we had a lot of collaborators in this thing, other agency folks, Park Service, National Marine Fisheries Service, California Abalone Association, of course, contributed several, many divers and boats and so forth. And we had the Reef Check group out there, a volunteer group of recreational divers. And like I said, 57 folks all together for a week. And I wanted to quickly mention we lost one of our colleagues recently. Chris Haugen of Reef Check was lost in a sailing accident in Monterey Bay last week, a couple weeks ago. And so we're all mourning that, especially his colleagues at Reef Check. And one of the things I wanted to say is that we tried to do a significant amount of data entry out there on site so that we could check the how we were doing and make adjustments. And so Alicia and I tried to not be green and do this data entry for 5 days. I think I did better than Alicia did, actually. All right, we had several boats out there. Sort of the center of it all was the Conception, which is a charter boat from Truth Aquatics. A lot of us lived on the boat and ate on the boat and so forth. We had the Coho. It's a fish and game enforcement vessel out there for most of the week. And the Garibaldi on the right there, it's a fish and game vessel that we often take out to the islands. And that's the Pacific Ranger and their crew that were out there for 2 or 3 days from the Channel Islands National Park. And then we had half a dozen commercial abalone boats out there and lots of skiffs to get people around. So this figure shows the kelp coverage around the island, and those little black things on there are the various stations that we set up prior to the survey. And I show there the Judith Rock Reserve on the lower left-hand side there, and the three zones that we did sample during the week. And I want to talk just for a minute about the basic design of the survey. It was a stratified random design, and I'm going to read this, because if I try to do this extemporaneously, I always screw it up, so I'm just going to read it. Stations were randomly located within kelp within the surf's blocks. And you may remember in that previous map that I showed, there was a lot of little numbers scattered all over the graph, and those were labels of 1 nautical mile blocks that are used for the California Recreational Fisheries Survey surfs. And so our stations were randomly located within the kelp within those blocks. And the proportion of a zone's stations within a block equaled the proportion of the zone's kelp in that block. The proportion of total stations within a zone equaled the proportion of total island kelp in that zone. So that's how we stratified this thing. And I wanted to say that because of the harsh weather conditions we had out there, we really couldn't spend much time out at the northwest area, so that zone is pretty poorly represented in our sample, or relatively unrepresented in the sample that we took. There's a lot of information on our FTP site about the protocol that we used. I encourage you to look at that if you have specific questions about that. But basically, at each station, we had 2 30-meter by 4-meter transects. And the first transect was along a randomly predetermined heading, and the second transect was along a 30-meter reciprocal heading. And each transect had 2 swaths, one on either side of the transect line, each done by 1 diver. And we recorded abalone in 5-meter segments. The first 30 abalone in a swath were measured, if they could be, and the remaining ones along a swath were just counted if they're more than 30. We collected habitat data at 10-meter intervals, depth, bottom relief, bottom type. Again, we haven't really looked at that data yet. And a few of the divers who were more expert in these things collected some algal data, particularly kelp stipe counts. And this was done at a subset of the stations. So just a few results here. And there's much more that can be done with this data. There's much more we will do with this data. And much of what we do with the data will be determined by what we talk about tomorrow and on into the future. The densities were not the same at all the zones that we sampled. If I'm getting ahead of myself here a little bit. This graph just shows the effort that we were able to pull off in each of the zones. And you can see the northwest zone is somewhat underrepresented there.
Question quickly. The northeast zone is not listed at all. Is there a reason for that?
Where's that question coming from?
From your right.
I'm sorry. I'm deaf in one ear, so I never know where sound comes from.
I thought there were four zones.
There are four zones, and virtually all of the habitat as we defined it, we were using kelp coverage as a surrogate for abalone habitat, was located in the three zones that we did sample. We didn't want to spend a lot of time in that area where we didn't think there would be abalone.
But the chart you showed showed sampling locations in the northeast zone.
Right.
So those were terminated?
Yeah, we did set up stations in that zone and then decided that we didn't want to expend the effort there. Yeah. For that reason. Yeah, we were just dealing with limited resources, basically, and we wanted to use them as effectively as we could. So that was the deal there. And as you can see there, we counted a total of about 5,600 abalone during the week in all the zones together. Just a word or two here about the densities that we observed. Clearly the northwest zone had the lowest density, at least in the areas that we're able to get into. The southwest zone had the highest densities on average, around 1,600 abalone per hectare. And, overall, the average was about 1,200, 1,300 abalone per hectare. And I want to caution you about expanding these numbers to the whole island or something like that, because we really need to approach that using the habitat data that we have and doing some weighting and things like that. This is a you could easily get a misimpression of the overall density situation or the total abundance of abalone out there if you just tried to expand these numbers by themselves based on the area only. One of the objectives was to document the presence and the density of abalone in the Judith Rock Reserve, which is in the western edge of the southwest zone. And what you can see here is that the reserve had somewhat lower densities than the remainder of the southwest zone, and about the average that we saw for the three zones as a whole. And this is just a picture of the relative density of the abalone at all the stations that we sampled. So you can see the distribution of the stations here. You can see that there were concentrations in the Crook Point area, which is to your right there, in the Tyler Bight area, which is adjacent to the Judith Rock area, and then just to the right of it, and then within the Judith Rock area. And you can see that there were relatively few abalone in the in that Castle Rock Northwest zone that we sampled in a limited way. And so that's sort of the general picture of what we saw in terms of the distribution of the abalone. And with respect to the size frequency, this was an emergent abalone survey. We weren't turning rocks over. We weren't setting up devices to catch little ones. This was just what you could see there, and the bigger as you swim by, and what you tend to see in this situation is the bigger ones. That the smaller ones tend to be more cryptic. But anyway, that's so that you need to keep that in mind. We have other means, I think, of getting at questions about recruitment and so forth. But this just gives you a picture of what the size frequency is for the larger abalone. And you can see that a good proportion of the abalone are above the what I call recreational size there, which is the current recreational size limit for Northern California, and also for the commercial size limit, which is what the limit was, 7 3/4 inches back in 1997 when they closed the fishery. And that's based on about 4,000 abalone measured. And this is just the densities, the station density frequency. So you could get a feeling for, how common it was for there to be high densities of abalone and conversely lower densities. And you can see that most of the stations had relatively low densities and that there were fewer with very high densities, and I think this is fairly typical of for red abalone. But it's going to be a consideration when we're talking about the design of any fisheries. And one more thing about the size frequency, clearly the abalone we saw in the northwest zone were generally smaller than what we saw in the other two zones, and 71% of the abalone in the northwest zone were sublegal, and a much smaller number of sublegal abalone in the other two zones. We did collect approximately 60 abalone for some health evaluation, and Laura worked on the reproductive condition of the abalone, and Jim Moore worked on examining them for disease. And the story is pretty simple here. The reproductive condition of the abalone appeared to be good and normal. The abalone did have, which I think is pretty common along the California coast, evidence of the withering syndrome bacteria infestation. It did not appear to be expressed really in any of the abalone that we examined. And Jim, indicated in his report that this is probably just due to the good cold water conditions that we have out there, which tends to suppress that disease. And just a word or two here about what we need to do next. We need to get the algal data entered that I talked about. We need to accomplish some basic habitat analysis. We want to do population estimates. We need the habitat analysis to do that, I think. I think population and harvest modeling is going to be critical to this fisheries consideration process. I don't think you can just base this on the standing stock that's out there. I think we need to bring in some of the vital factors and model them. And we are very interested in what goes on at this workshop tomorrow so that we can hopefully will guide our analysis. And thank you for watching.
Okay, so now we'd like to bring forward our first invited panelist, Dr. Jeremy. If you want to hold, unless it's really critical now, I'd say hold it and we can talk about it in the panel, because I don't know if it'll be answered or not. But Dr. Jeremy Prince, and Jeremy, I'll let you introduce yourself with regards to who you are. Welcome, and voila.
Thank you, John. I think maybe I wanted to sort of spend a bit of time in my talk just giving a general introduction to our experience with abalone fisheries in Australia and what's come out of our research into these fisheries. And I think that'll probably give a bit of background as to who I am. So I won't say too much about myself. I began my life really as a recreational fisher. That got me into marine biology as a researcher. I found myself working in the Tasmanian fishery in the early 80s at a time of when we needed intense change. I was involved in putting the first ever ITQ system into an abalone fishery. This is the world's biggest abalone fishery since the demise of you guys in Mexico. And I also was involved in sort of some fundamental research. Since I had a period of time as a senior researcher at a fisheries institute in Australia, and then I've been freelance fisheries assessment consultant, not just on abalone, but a wide range of fisheries in Australia since that time. And through the 90s, until a few years ago, I also, as a summer job, I was free diving for 4 ton of abalone quota in New Zealand. I'm Australian, but I have strong affiliations to New Zealand. Since selling my quota a couple of years ago, I'm back to just being a recreational diver again. So I'll let the rest come out through the talk. So this is a brief outline of what I want to run through fairly quickly. Just some backgrounding ideas on what the problem of sustaining abalone fisheries has been worldwide. leading to a concept that I like to call the tyranny of scale, and then to into an idea of how we're actually trying to address this issue in Australia at the moment. I then want to despite the counselling, not to analyse this data too far at this point in time. I probably want to rush in like a fool where angels would fear to tread, give you some idea of what my initial analysis of this situation would be, both the history as well as the data, and then finally finish off with some comments about what I think the options for management are in this situation. So I don't think we need to go too much about the poor history of management we've had with abalone right around the world, but it was this issue as a time of rapidly expanding catches that I began working in abalone research and management in the early 80s in Tasmania. It was natural for me that most of the divers in the fishery were actually guys that I'd been swimming spearfishing championships against for quite a few years, and they'd been roundly beating me most of the time. So it was natural when I landed and started working in their fishery that I'd actually go and talk to them about what they thought was going on. Also, swimming competition spearfishing while I was going through university, it taught me that if I really wanted to learn something about fish, I went and talked to fishermen, not to researchers. And so I just had this, it was natural in my head to start off talking to people who are out there doing every day. One of the very first things they told me, at that time we had Mia Tegner's work drifting bottles around the California, the islands, and working out that these bottles in 8 to 10 days, the larval life of abalone, were moving 80 to 90 kilometres. But the divers I was talking to actually were describing patterns, a reef just here which would die and never come back, and just a kilometre away, another reef maintaining healthy populations. And to me that didn't seem consistent with this observation that larvae were moving 80 to 90 kilometres. We developed a technique and became the first people in the world to start seeing the very small, the cryptic abalone, in their real numbers. Up until that time, it was assumed that they were actually just naturally rare in the environment. But that gave us a tool where we could actually start looking for patterns for recruitment. And this is an experiment we did where... have I got a pointer here? Yes, I have. Where basically we took 60-metre sections of shoreline and stripped them of the emergent population, and we came back straight after the breeding season and had a look at what was settling into those areas compared to control areas, which we hadn't manipulated. If you just want to come over to the right-hand side of the graph, which is the summary figures, down the bottom shows the pattern of breeding stock. These points, the high points here, show the from one control through the experimental area before we manipulated through to the other side, the other control. Where's my pointer gone? There it is. This difference here was at the effect of our experimental manipulation, the stripping out of the emergent abalone. What we saw when we came back was that on these scales of tens of metres, 60 metres, we had manipulated the density of recruitment. And this was starting to be the first evidence we had, and it's been built on since this time. This was the first evidence we had that, at least in terms of fisheries, I won't make this statement about geological timeframes. I believe some dispersal does go on and is necessary for all species to be invasive. Some larvae have to move long distances. But really, in terms of your recruitment that's going to sustain the fishery, we need to be thinking in tens to metres to hundreds of metres in terms of their dispersal ability, which is similar to the adults. And so what we're dealing with is not large fisheries. We're dealing with hundreds or tens of thousands of very small microfisheries, which actually need management. If they're all uniform and divers accessed them all uniformly, then we could treat them as a big unit. But that's not what happens. Not only do the divers prefer some areas to other areas for diving, but what we actually see is that the size of maturity is highly variable. And let me just showcase that with two research sites that I used. These were selected haphazardly in this regard. I didn't realise they were going to vary in this regard, and it fell out of my research. So these two studies don't actually reflect the full natural variability we see in these populations. What you've got up here is in this top row, is the size profile of the cryptic population. It turns out that the cryptic population is the juvenile population. What you've got down here, where's my pointer? In these next ones down, are the adult population. It's the emergent population. What I want you to note is the line in these figures is the commercial size limit at that time. And you'll see the very different place in terms of the mature population that line is between the blubberhead and the Georgia Third Rock population. What we're seeing with these animals is that they're growing on, they're doing similar things at this, roughly the same age. So between the populations in Tasmania, we're finding that they're basically mostly mature, about 10 years of age. But 10 years of age can be this big in one spot and that big in another spot. So then when you line that up and you have a look at what your size limit, which is generally applied across a country or in Australia across an entire state or zone, hundreds of kilometres, what you find is that you'll have some populations, which in Australia we tend to call stunted populations. Here I notice the term is shorties. British Columbia, they call them surf abalone. And so you'll have these populations which are naturally protected because the measure, the size limit, is basically allowing very little harvest to go on. In contrast, you'll have the commercial beds, the commercially favoured beds, where basically the size limit is giving no protection at all. And these populations can be legally stripped of all breeders. And these populations, as eventually divers get around to favouring these sites and concentrate on them, then they are start sliding away into recruitment collapse. And so this turns out to be the major issue facing us, is this highly variable size of maturity. It's compounded by the fact that we researchers, almost uniformly, everywhere where I can test this and find out where the research was done compared to the fishery, turns out one of the major factors driving this size of maturity is actually water movement. These abalone prefer very, very high rates of water movement. So the headlands, the promontories, will have a very large size of maturity, and the backs of the bays will have a very low size of maturity. Well, we're researchers. We had to book our research vessel out 6 weeks in advance. We couldn't just turn around and use whatever weather was there. When our number came up on the board for booking it out, we had to go and work. So we naturally chose, assuming that these phenomena would be uniform, we naturally chose the sheltered sites. And so in jurisdiction after jurisdiction, if you look at where the early work on setting the size limits was done, it was done in places that were sheltered and had a small size of maturity. So largely, across all nations and jurisdictions, we find that often the size limits were set way too small to actually be useful for the commercial beds of abalone. Here's a collection of shells from a range of sites across a single jurisdiction in Australia, just showing you the very great range in abalone that you'll get at a site. All of these are legally mature. Up here we have animals that have probably had 10 or 15 years of breeding at full fecundity. Down here, we have animals that haven't even developed a gonad yet. They are newly emerged. And these are all legal. This is quite a large abalone in this fishery down the bottom. And this is the type of things, the range of populations that we're actually trying to manage with a sort of one-size-fits-all approach, a spatially uniform approach. Now, I want to show you just the sort of range of scales that this phenomena occurs across. I'm using here, this is Neil Andrews' work from New Zealand. And over here, there's three sites he's documented the growth rates are. Note where the size limit is. Taranaki is up here in the warmer water. Banks Peninsula is down here. And the east coast of Stewart Island is down here. Now, if you went to the west coast of Stewart Island or Fieldland, you'd find that there are families of growth curves that are way up here, basically going, so with the one size limit for the entire country, note that that work was done down here, and that is an area which is persisting very well in the fishery. Up in the northern part of the fishery, the conclusion was there's no commercial fishery up there because nothing gets to legal size, so there was never any catch history. And the conclusion there was the entire recreational fishery in northern New Zealand is illegal. Nothing is reaching legal size. And so what we're seeing across this fishery is a very dramatic recruitment collapse in the bottom half of the South Island, some level of sustaining north of there, and basically an unexploited stock in the north. Now, that's a scale of hundreds to thousands of kilometres. When we come down to this south-east corner, which is an area where I was my base, summertime base for diving, we have a very, very exposed... Come back. We have a very exposed open ocean coastline, big sea cliffs along here, going around to quite a sheltered bay. And you see what you see is a very large size of maturity along this bit of coastline here. This scale we're talking along here is about 40 kilometres. Coming around into this bay here, you basically have a cline, a gradual change through a very small size of maturity. So by the time you're about here, you can no longer legally pick abalone. What we've seen go on in this fishery is an almost total recruitment collapse along this bit of coastline. I had a friend who used to take about 5 ton a year himself out of this little bay here. Other divers work there as well. Last time we swam it, we saw 5 abalone. That's how total the collapse has been. This area used to be, because we're free diving and very dirty water, where you'd have to measure, there'd be one sized amongst 100 along here, and so you have 100 emergent abalone with only one legal size. And no one used to like to fish in here because it was so dirty and it was so much hard work sorting through the undersize to find a legally sized. Now, any calm day, there'll be 8 boats sitting in here and there'll be no boats out here. Now, this is the type of phenomena we have going on these fisheries. Let me take you now to the southwest corner of Australia and a scale of about 2 kilometres. And this is a map that was mapped for me and by the commercial divers who were first to fish this area, and then we ground-truthed it. And what I've shown here by colour, from the dark is a very large size of maturity to the light is a very small size of maturity, and noting that the legal size basically only would protect the small and small to average categories. And what happened, the divers who discovered this area quite late in the development of the fishery, they had some inkling of what was going on, and at first they had a voluntary size limit quite a lot higher than the legal size limit. And this sustained the area at about 30 tonne of meat a year until finally one of the divers said, no, I'm just going to do the legal thing. And then there was a gold rush. And the fishery basically collapsed down to just being confined to these light areas. And from 30 tonne of meat, the fishery collapsed down to about 8 tonne of meat. And was still going down when I started working with these guys in this area to manipulate a recovery. So this is the issue, what I call the tyranny of scale, that we've been managing and enforcing on a regional scale, a scale of hundreds of kilometres, a single size limit, a single quota system, limited entry over this sort of scale. In recent years, we've been starting to get the scale of a data collection. Data used to be collected on this scale as well. Now we're getting data on a scale of square kilometres to tens of kilometres. But really, the challenge is to bring management and data collection and stock assessment down to the scale of these animals. You know, paper by Hilborn and others recently in Science suggesting that this mismatch of scale and of the animal and the scale of management is one of the 3 main reasons fisheries collapse, not just in abalone, across the board with fisheries. So this is the tyranny of scale, how we get down to managing these animals at the scale appropriate to them. Let me just... management is always a movable feast, an evolving process. And I just want to, laying some of the context for my comments later, I just want to work you through a brief history of what's gone on in Australia, and just really illustrating the fact that you use the best knowledge you have at the time and you put measures into place, and then later on different stresses turn up and you have to react. And so the management really needs to be a work in progress, adaptive, and responding to the issues as they emerge. So this is what happened in Australia. This is Australian abalone production. What I've marked in is when we manage it in Australia as 5 separate jurisdictions. Generally, Tasmania, with the biggest fishery, has led the way in management change, and the other states have followed fairly quickly. One state has lagged a long way behind, and its catch statistics, not in size but in trend, pretty much follow California. But I don't think they have as much chance of recovery as you people have. So these dates here are really about Tasmania, but are indicative of what's gone in Australia. Very quickly after the development of the fishery in 64, size limits were put on, but we made the same mistake of doing our research in a sheltered location and putting a size limit across the entire state, which really wasn't protecting most of our core legal beds, our commercial beds. In 69, two leaders of state fishery agencies in Australia reacted very much to Gareth Hardin's paper on the tragedy of the commons and started putting into place limited entry schemes to control access to these fisheries. At first, these went in and there was just a waiting. There was no transferability. You couldn't sell your licence. You just, if you wanted to retire, you gave it back to the department and they handed it out again. And what we saw is after the divers set themselves up, they then basically started relaxing and we saw a big decline in catch, which some jurisdictions actually saw as a decline of the stocks, and they were disabused of that opinion later on. In 1974, Tasmania at least opened up the market for transferability, and then divers could start selling to each other. What we saw was a rapid escalation of the price and the indebtedness of the new divers. And so the divers reversed the relaxed nature of the fishery and the declining catches, and in jurisdiction after jurisdiction, we started seeing catches climb after we had transferability. In Tasmania, where I worked, the catches went from a long-term average of about 2,500 tonnes, 2,000 tonnes, up to 6,000 tonnes the year after I arrived and started working there. In 85, we had agreement to put in a system of individually transferable quotas. And in Tasmania, we used that introduction of that system to reduce the catch from over 6,000 tonnes to 4,200 tonnes in a year. That quota then over the subsequent years, I worked, I had a disagreement with my own department who wanted to keep the catches high, and I ended up working with the divers. And in 1 year, would have been 87, we had 109 of 125 licence holders present at a meeting where we had a preferential vote, and we voted for a 30% decrease in their quota. We then had to lobby the fisheries minister in opposition to the department to drive the quota down. After that, we had the quota down to 2,200 tonnes, and for time, things really improved markedly until eventually, some years later, some processing interests drove the quota back up to some extent. In Tasmania, they began to zone the fishery in 1999. Some of the other jurisdictions started earlier than that. What you see at the end of this time series, which ends in 2003, is the quotas beginning to come down. And this, if I had the data through to most recent one, we'd see a steady progression down of that catch. And what we're really recognising, a lot of people thought that individual transferability, ITQ was going to be the be-all and end-all of management, and really it bought us a lot of time. It was tremendously successful, it was a great step forward, but still, this problem of serial depletion, the small scale, the mismatch in scales between management and the beast, began to slowly become evident. And it's in the last few years that no one can deny it anymore. A few of us have been predicting this was going to happen, and because we're in touch with the industry, have been observing it happen, even though it hasn't been showing up in the official stats, which are still too coarse. It's only now just starting to show up in the official stock assessments, because again, the scale of these assessments being zonal scales really cannot capture the serial depletion effect that's going on. And it's only now that it's quite advanced, the assessments are starting to turn slightly negative. In my opinion, they're still overly optimistic, and we're probably going to be seeing catches come down for quite some time to come. So what's the future? I'd like to think that we've started the processes to turn this around. And some others have received quite a major funding from our main funding body for an initial four-year project, development project for the industry, really about developing fine-scale management for the fishery and integrating the fine-scale processes with the existing state zonal assessment processes. The funding body has indicated to us that they believe this is the future of the industry. They believe that beyond this four-year funding, that this is a long-term process we're talking about, and they've indicated that they're going to fund and support this process for 10 to 20 years if it takes that long to change the industry. Our experience with the other forms of management change is that once you finally get people's heads around what's needed, they're capable of quite rapid change, and once you have change in one jurisdiction, it sweeps through the other jurisdictions. At the moment, we're working in three of the five jurisdictions. So I believe that this is the future. And I just want to explain very quickly what these premises are about, the way we're seeking to integrate the bottom-up with the top-down. And this is ideas that were given to me by a West Australian abalone diver, the one who we worked with in 94, who provided those maps for us. And he gave me an observation back then, which I poo-pooed in my super superior researcher type of fashion. And he was talking about these high hat abalone divers. And the principle that they used very successfully to recover their bottom was that each diver had to assess each aggregate. He tried to send back. We only fished the area we were recovering once a year. Every spot got fished once a year. They might take two or three days to cover the area. He would direct them to where they were going to fish. and they were to assess each aggregation on its own merits and to work out what was the size of these high-hat shells. And then they were only to take one-third of the high-hat shells. And these were all above legal size, but often they were considerably above legal size. And they weren't allowed to take the biggest of the high-hat shells. They had to take across the size. It was quite across the size range. It was quite an elaborate process that he'd got them up. And so I thought, yeah, whatever. And but then through my... I was spending my summers as a commercial diver in New Zealand, and I was able to test these ideas. The divers I was with, it was a mother boat operation. They had landed about a third of a 450-ton TAC every year for the southern third of New Zealand, and they had kept very good private logbooks over the 20-year period. During the day, I could swim an area. I could observe the shell, and then I could make my own predictions using these ideas about high-hat shells and make my own predictions as to what was going on in the area. Was it going backwards? Was it stable? And then I could get aboard that night, and these guys would tell me, not in kilos per hour, but in kilos per length of coastline covered, what was going on with the resource. In some places, they'd tell me, yeah, we've taken 2 tons from this point to that point for as long as we can remember, 2 tons a year. But here, no, we used to take 2 tons just in that corner of the bay, and now we swim 4 bays for 2 tons. And from that, I could calibrate this technique and work out that, blow me down, Terry Adams knew what he was talking about. And then I went back and I could see, actually, it was in my data. I could see what they were talking about. And it comes back to the fact that they are merging from the cryptic habitat into the emergent population about the time they begin maturing. Now, this is a black and white statement. In fact, there's more grey than this, but I won't go in. I don't have the time to go in. Different types of bottom force some different types of behaviour. But generally, this is what abalone is about. They emerge as they begin to mature. So this is the story. As juveniles and subadults, they're hidden away, wedged in crevices inside the reef, and they have a very flat shell shape, a very oval shell shape, and very little fouling. Upon maturing, in the maturing process, they crawl out from the deep ledges and start becoming exposed to the light, and they start changing shell shape. They start putting volume into the shell to hold their gonad. They start becoming rounded and bowl-like, both round that way and rounded over the top, and the fouling process and the erosion process begins. And this is really what's going on. Here's a growth curve from my Georgia rock population, which was the faster-growing one. And these animals, here's the growth in length and the growth in weight. And basically, at this, as they start, the curve starts to inflect. At that point, they're beginning to mature, and they're a clean, flat, oval shell. By the time they're actually reaching full adult fecundity, the shell is rounding up, and the fouling process is well and truly started. And if you compare a couple of populations, and I'll go back to those populations that I had before. Now, here we're talking in length on both of them. That at the same age, they'll be doing very, very similar things, even though they can be very different lengths. And so in these populations, there's a good 40 mil difference at the size of full maturity. But these shells, if you don't have a scale on them, if you don't have a measure next to them, you're just looking at the characteristics of the shell, at the same level of maturity, the same age, they will look very, very similar. The fouling process, the rounding up, the change in shape, is quite a uniform thing, and it seems to be worked right across a lot of species. So this is really the change we see from the animals that start leaving the crevice spaces and start wandering out towards the front of the crevices to the animals that are actually out in front of the crevice to the animals out here that have been out of the crevices on the flat of the reef for some years. Now, basically, you know, all in this population here, all these animals are legal. This animal back here will have a fecundity of probably 10,000. This animal up here will have a fecundity of probably 1 million. This animal up here will have a fecundity of 3 million. And we've been fishing them way back here. And in fishery after fishery, that's what we've been doing. So this is what we're doing to try and get a bottom-up process going. I'm teaching divers a very basic process. I'm teaching them that juvenile abalone remain hidden within the reef. Subadult shells grow in length and remain thin and flat. They live cryptically, wedged into dark crevices, and the shells remain free of growth. As they mature, abalone move out of the cryptic habitat to join adult feeding and breeding aggregations. The shells rapidly thicken as growth is in volume rather than length. shells become higher and rounder as adult fecundity is achieved. The shells become fouled by epiphytic growth and take on the appearance of the reef surface. Maturing abalone takes several years to attain full adult fecundity and should be allowed several years of breeding with their full adult fecundity before being harvested. Shells being harvested should be high, rounded, and covered with fouling growth. When a catch is predominantly clean, flat shells, a reef is being recruited overfished. Individuals are not being left to attain full adult fecundity and are not being allowed sufficient breeding to sustain future production. So these are the basic principles we're trying to apply reef by reef in these zones. And we actually have, this is our decision tree by which we are basically just using basic catch data, fine scales catch data, and the appearance of shells. We, with groups of divers, we hold workshops and we assess their fisheries reef by reef. We have 8 exploitation categories from 1 down here, where basically the collapse happened a long time ago, down to 8 where there's basically never any natural productivity. Coming up to 7, which are the shorty patches or the stunted stocks, where our management aim should be actually to increase access. And then at the other end, the ones which we think that need some active rehabilitation. And the 4s, the 5s and the 6s, where we either have to watch closely or pull back, or really at 6, we basically want them all down at where they're going to hold themselves forever. And we have a breeding stock, a biomass, adult biomass composed of 10 or so year classes. So we're working with the associations. These associations, having worked with them for several years, they're now at the stage where they'll be given they sign MOUs with the government to get their TAC, their total allowable catch, and the MOUs will say to the government how they intend to manage, allocate their catch between reefs. So one zone I work with has 36 reef codes, between each reef code is between 1 kilometre long and 5 kilometres long, and they are allocating a 250-tonne TAC individually to each of those reefs. Each of those reefs will also have its own size limit. In some of these reef codes, we have several size limits. These are enforced through a mixture of peer group pressure. Some of these measures are voluntary and you can't take legal action, but by hell, they can pull people in a line and give them a hard time in the pub if they're doing the wrong thing. Some of the measures, basic measures are legal and you've been prosecuted for breaking, and others where we want to access shorty beds that are below the legal size limit, we apply for permits to the government, and under strict conditions, they can be fished at a lower size limit. So that's where we're going. We have where we set up this process. First few meetings where we go through these basic principles, there'll be 3 or 4 people from the association in the room, and over the 2 years introductory period, the numbers grow and grow and grow, and people get very enthusiastic. We see it not only amongst the industry, but we see the government people. Scales falling off their eye as they understand actually what's been going on in the fishery and what we're about. And we're really very, very excited that this is the beginning of a big process of change in our fisheries. So, turning from Australia to what I, with that sort of mindset and worldview, how I, my biases or my prejudices, my interpretation of what I think has gone on in California. Well, and it's pretty close to what Christina said. I believe you've had a typical case of serial depletion. I believe that your legal size limits were not conservative for most of the abalone beds, and so basically uncontrolled exploitation levels serially depleted your resource over time. I think the catch figures there showed it pretty clearly. I believe San Miguel was basically a relatively, comparatively a shorty bed compared to the rest of your fishery. I believe it had a relatively low size of maturity, and so your size limit did a better job of preserving the resource. We also note that it's more remote, so that would have helped to hold down the level of fishing pressure. And also probably being closer to the core range of the red abalone, the population there was better able to withstand the other impacts that we know have been a major effect here in California. I want to note that across many, many fisheries which have breeding biomasses composed of many age classes, we are now starting to understand that it's those multiple age classes that give the stocks resilience. Some of these populations only get to have effective breeding every 4 or 5 years, that they believe the gooey duck in Washington is only getting effective recruitment every 70 or 80 years. You know, these species, there's a reason they have a lot of year classes in their breeding stock. It's to give them resilience against these factors, to give them resilience against 10 years of El Nino or whatever comes along. When we fish them heavily and get them down to being a few year classes of low fecundity animals, we've stripped them of their natural resilience. And I believe very much that you basically pushed your stock right down and it had no natural resilience to the various insults that came along afterwards, the El Nino being one of them. So let's talk about San Miguel. And I just want to, before I sort of get to my summarising points, I want to just sort of share a few of the observations on your data and give you some insight as to the way I would, having looked at a lot of this data and a lot of different fisheries, and quite fine scale, how I would actually interpret these data. So at the top we have the size structure that's just been documented in the reserves after 10 years of closure. And we've just seen this. Let's assume that after 10 years this is a relatively virgin resource in terms of the size structure. I don't want to assume that in terms of the amount of abalone there, but in terms of its size structure, it's starting to get back towards being relatively unexploited. I know it's not a virgin stock in size structure, and particularly not in biomass, but let's just make the assumption that it's getting to be something like a natural size structure. Well, I believe that to be conservative, you basically need a size limit that is out here on the downward limb. Around about the peak here is what we would call probably just past the peak is what we would call L infinity, the average maximum size in the population. That is the size that 50% or the average size, so 50% of the animals, when they finish growing, should be above that, and 50% should be below that. So if you want to set, and I'm using a rule of thumb here, rule of thumb is that 40 or 50% of your breeding biomass should be a fairly conservative place to manage your fishery. So if you want to have 50% of your breeding stock protected, then because the animals on the lower side of your L infinity are going to be your lower fecundity animals, the animals on the higher side are going to be the higher side, then basically in a virgin stock, your size limit should be at or above your L infinity, which will be somewhere over here.
I'm sorry, but do you have, is that your opinion?
Well, it's based
on representing a virgin stock profile, or is this a relic, an artifact of overharvesting and serial depletion?
Well, we've had 10 years of recovery, so I'm accepting that there is still some impact of fishing. So all these things I'm saying are basically rules of thumb. So they're none of them are precise, but they're general guiding principles.
But they're not supported by any of the studies so far.
That one about the 50%, 40-50% breeding biomass is an accepted rule of thumb coming out of a principle that Gullen put forward in the 70s. Across all fisheries. These aren't just straight out of my own head. And the modelling on size structure, I've done a lot of modelling on size structure. So I can tell you where, if this was a virgin size structure, the L infinity would be about there.
But it's not a virgin size
structure.
No,
but it's had 10 years of recovery. So the adults in that population, well, you know, you've had 10 basically unexploited years. So it's getting back to being something like it. It would actually be over here, but right. That would support my argument that the size limit should be even higher than it is now.
General, you're using the word recovery synonymous with changes in abundance. Recovery may be in growth of the population size. It's different from any evidence of recovery in abundance or numbers.
I'm distinguishing between a recovery in biomass and a recovery in... And what I'm talking about here is recovery of size.
Well, if you were an error, as he's describing, would that tend to call for a larger size than you're saying now, or
yes.
Smaller?
Both of those. I'm saying if this was a virgin population, and really, if we left this alone for 100 years, you'd probably see it be even more filled out down here, right? If you left for 100 years, then this size structure would change a bit, and your numbers out there would probably change a whole lot more.
So let's continue the talk and finish the discussion when we have time for discussion later.
Thanks, John. let me then pull you back down to these figures here, which were collected in 99, 6 months after the fishery closed, and where we've got the recreational size limit and the commercial size limit shown. And you can see that, in fact, this is getting pretty much down to the population is basically knife edge on the recreational size limit. So the effective size limit in this population was way back down here. So, you know, I'm talking about a size limit that was probably that we should probably have out there was probably something 30 to 40 mils larger than the recreationals we're using. And probably, you know, getting towards being 20, 25 mils greater than the commercial guys we're using. So that I just want to put that interpretation because that's the basis for one of the things I'm going to say about management later on. The idea that your resource out there was relatively stable but at a low level, that your seismic was giving you some level of protection, more level of protection than a lot of other places on your coast, but not enough protection, is actually supported by your sort of the catch trends since 50. You know, that would suggest that these catches of around about 125,000 pounds was something like stable. You know, you certainly wouldn't...
We've had discussion. These are not necessarily representative of actual... These were not verified.
No, but why don't you hold your question till the end, please?
Because we have inadequate time for questions at the end.
But what I'd suggest to you now, just looking at the survey data, which I'll rush in and make some use of, would suggest that this was, while it looks stable, was actually way lower than optimum. So that, to me, supports the suggestion that, yes, there was a level of production, there was a level of stability out there before the closure, but it was very much suboptimal. So let's put into mind that 125,000 pounds for our next comment. So those are two sort of observations, a bit the data. They're not precise observations, I'll give you that, but in these, when you're trying to get to fine scale, there is no precise data, you have to start using rules of thumb. So, comments on the data. I'll get back to the fishery comments after this, but let me first of all comment on the survey. First of all, I've seen a lot of surveys like this. I've seen a lot of these surveys badly misfire. I think I need to congratulate you guys on a great job well done. This is a really fantastic result you've got. Extremely large number of transects. I've also been privy to some mapping that the out of their own heads of their putting together the knowledge that the commercial divers have done and putting onto a map of where they believe the beds of abalone are. And there's a great coincidence between where they believe the beds are and where your surveys are showing the animals are. Something which gives me great confidence in your data. I really do think you guys need to be congratulated on what you've done. I have a high level of confidence in your snapshot result. This is basically this looks almost identical to the qualitative mapping the industry have done themselves. I'm going home to do some surveys in Western Australia. I'm going to do the process the other way around. We're going to start with a workshop where the divers do their qualitative mapping, and then we don't have nice surface beds of kelp to do this on, so we're forced to use the diver knowledge first, and then we'll stratify from there. You know, you guys didn't follow that process, but you've achieved the same end. I just hope we can have something like your density of sampling. So then let me be the fool and rush in where the angels are fearing to tread. How would I use these data? And these, again, these aren't precise. You're going to make much more precise use of this, but again, I'm a field biologist. I'm used to having to make hard decisions with almost no data. So these are the numbers as I'd work it out. It basically comes out to you've got an emergent population of something like 1 million abs out there. Now, I'll apply another rule of thumb, which is also very, very widely used in the field of fisheries internationally, is that the maximum sustainable level of fishing is achieved when, or you shouldn't be exceeding where your F, that's your fishing mortality, should not be higher than your level of natural mortality. And when you're in that ballpark, you're probably at the maximum level of sustainable fishing, and if you start going over that, we'd start defining that as over-exploitation. Okay. Then let's use the accepted range of figures in the literature, that the natural mortality of abalone is between about 15% and 20%. That's an annual rate. And these assumptions about poundage and value. And then we go down here against you. This is your range of Fs. So I'm suggesting that we go below the 0.2 or the 0.15, take a precautionary approach, go to a 10%. And that comes out at a catch of something like, or a potential harvest out there of something like 100,000 abalone, or about 300,000 pounds. Now let me, in that 300 or close to 400,000 pounds, let's go back to what the catch was when the fishery ended out there, which was about 100,000 pounds. Now that's my basis for saying that population was being held at a suboptimal level. It looked to me like it was stable, but it was not really serving your community very well. It wasn't being managed well. It wasn't collapsing, but it wasn't doing well either. So let me go from there. That's my interpretation of your situation. I accept it's quick and dirty, but I think you'll find it surprisingly accurate as well. So these are my comments about your potential options for management. Don't have the time to give you the options, but let me just throw at you from my experience where I think if you want a productive future for your community in general, these are the types of things you're going to have to take on. You know, I think that there is potential for limited fishery. At a value of something like 5 million, we'd actually call it one of our medium-sized fisheries, not a small fishery. We in Australia specialise in small fisheries. Small fisheries for us are worth under $150,000 a year. And we still manage them effectively. I think that this could be used to fund the development of a brand new approach to management, which is obviously needed, but I think you should be thinking of it as an evolutionary process, that this is something that you can develop and work with. I think you have a golden opportunity here with this one small place you can focus on as the other rest of your resource comes back for preparing yourselves for how you're going to deal with this fantastic premium resource when it's back in 30 or 40 years' time in its former glory. I think you must think about developing some form of property rights for this fishery. We have learnt through hard experience, and this is now in New Zealand and Iceland, which share the world lead in sustainable fisheries, have proved, and this is now documented. I know America isn't fond of the United Nations, but the United Nations now recognise as a base of sustainable fisheries is some form of property rights. And the better the form of property rights, the better the performance in management. I know you Americans are very fond of your freedom and everyone has the freedom to go and fish, but I think Harden, who gave me the first name of Harden last night? Gareth Harden, I got it right back in 67 when he pointed out that the solution to the tragedy of the commons is relinquishing existing rights and freedoms. And basically you're faced with a choice in sustainable fisheries. You can have the right for everyone to fish in a controlled sense, but you can't have a fish stock as well. If you want a fish stock, some of your existing rights and freedoms must be given up. And I believe you must have a form of property rights so that people start acting in long term with their long-term interest in mind. Your management is going to have some explicit total allowable catch. That's absolutely essential. I think long term, you're going to have a spatially explicit form of management as well. Perhaps initially, while you're just dealing with San Miguel, that might be a small enough unit of area, particularly if you've got it cut into four. That may be spatially explicit enough for the time being. But if this approach is going to get expanded to other areas, it's going to need to be far more spatially explicit than that. You know, at a scale of several miles, you're dealing with an order of magnitude to two order of magnitudes, bigger scale of management than these stocks are operating on. And I think you should probably watch what we're doing in Australia very closely over time. Noting that up here, the forms of property rights, property rights come in a lot of different forms, from just limited entry, which more or less you had when the fishery closed, and which is a very imprecise form of control, through to ITQ, which is much more precise but is not spatially explicit, through the turf, territorial user rights. You know, this is a farming approach. This is why shouldn't abalone, which don't move far, be treated any different to how we manage a private woodlot or a grape vineyard or a veggie patch. You know, people should be managing these things individually and learning how to work with their own bits of bottom. So ultimately, I think you're going to, even if it's not as radical as a TURF idea, territorial user rights, you're going to have to think of ways of making this spatially explicit and matching size limits and catches to the particular populations you're exploiting. Now, when we talk about property rights, I think where we in Australia have got it wrong and where we're slowly trying to drag it back is that we never linked the rights we gave people strongly enough to their responsibilities. Rights and responsibilities should be linked explicitly. You know, if you are given a right to harvest, you must have a responsibility to manage and gather data as well. And what I'm talking about here is both funding, people paying for their right to fish, so there is funding available to do things, but also to have a responsibility to collect the type of data we need. Fishermen collecting fishery-independent data, that's what I mean. That's not a contradiction. Fishermen can do structured scientific surveys, and they should be required to. And I think that your recent survey is a great beginning to that process. I think it can go a long, long way yet, but it's a great, great beginning. Fishing needs to be part of the research process. I'd suggest, and this is something I'm advocating in many different fisheries, is that license renewable should be conditional on the responsibilities being fulfilled. You know, in this situation, participating in the scientific surveys should be a condition of having your license renewed. Things like that, where there is no right without the responsibility. And then I've touched on why I believe that you need a larger size limit. With regard to the recreational sector, one of the problems with the world has travelled too long on the idea that we recreational fishermen don't have an impact. You know, for a long time we were small in number and very inefficient in our practices, and it was a correct assumption. But particularly considering the fact that these exploitation events occur in certain locations and not others, serial depletion, we amateurs, we recreationals, can have a major impact in areas. We tend to be conservative in the area we cover with our diving. You know, you see the places next to the boat ramps or the bays adjacent to boat ramps going down badly and all the commercial pressure moving away because the recreational sector is depressing them. You see fish stocks around major cities basically being pushed into local extinction. You know, this isn't commercial pressure. We have to face it that our fishing techniques, recreational and commercial, our fishing technology is now so powerful that even we recreationals can start damaging these stocks. Unfortunately, I see no way that we can get through to giving property rights to recreationals because that would mean excluding some people. For me, that's a great tragedy. I don't see how we're really going to solve the management of recreational fisheries without being able to get through that essential tool of property rights, but we've got to try. I think one of our ways around that is to start being very specific in spatially explicit. So I'm talking about spatial allocations here. A thing like an abalone, giving recreationals their own recreational fisheries distinct from the commercial fisheries. So then at least the two sectors can start knowing who's responsible for the trends going on. We see a lot of finger-pointing going on all over the world where commercials saying that's the recreationals and the recreationals say, oh, that's not us, that's the... We're all in this together and we have to be able to recognise our own footprints. And while we're all mixed up, I don't see that finger-pointing stopping. I don't see our attention being on how can I address my problem. I think there has to be explicit catch controls. We can't control the number of people who want to participate, so we have to find a way of controlling the catch. I think the examples here in North America where you people start off controlling access to different hiking trails, the hunting on the land, that sort of thing, I think that leads the way for us in fisheries. And the final point I'd make, is for the recreational sector, is having a different size limit is a nonsense. Size limits should be about biological control. It should be about sustaining, preserving sufficient levels of breeding stock to sustain the population. There can't be two of those. Taking an abalone is taking an abalone. You can't have different size limits. That's just one final point that goes across. I see a lot of talk about rehabilitation or enhancement. I really think that we should accept that reseeding, outplanting, is a very risky and not a process and not cost effective. You know, we are. It's a major route for disease, exotic disease, into these stocks. You guys have proved it here. We have a major disease outbreak just started in Australia. It actually came out of a hatchery that was in water, that was next to beds, only a few months before we had done a major outplanting from that hatchery. And but for a few months, we could have spread this thing right around our fishery. We've got enough damage rolling out with the natural spread, but if we'd augmented that through our outplanting, it would have been absolutely... But it's not cost-effective. The time lags involved... You know, if you talk an animal 10 years through to maturity... These things are, you reseed them, they're going to be 10 years before they mature, another 10 years before you see the progeny of those reseed animals. If you move from close by, there are always patches of shorties or stunted. These animals are not genetically stunted, it's purely conditions. You move them short distances, handle them well, you'll have about 98% survival. These animals will be putting a million spat back on the bottom from day one, basically. You know, let's get real. If we want to be cost-effective in this, if we want to be safe, any of these manipulations are going to have genetic impacts. By bringing shorties from nearby, you're going to minimise that, you minimise your disease impacts, and it's cost-effective. So that's my final comment. Thank you.
Okay, and now our last presentation before we get to our roundtable is Dr. Chris DeWeese. And, you know, I was at a meeting with Chris on Tuesday, and we each had 5 minutes to speak, and I think I used 11 of my 5 minutes, and Chris did probably 4 of his. So hopefully we've given you enough time tonight. And do you have a presentation on this? Is it?
No, I don't.
Oh, okay, great. Okay, he's just
great.
Talking.
He said great, no PowerPoint. Yeah. Okay. I think before I start, I think everybody's butt's getting sore. So why don't you stand up for just a minute? Don't leave the room. Close the doors. Lock the door. Just wiggle your rear ends, because my butt was sore.
Thank you, Chris.
Yeah, okay. Yeah, right. Well, I read your body language. This is not a break. This is a stretch. Okay. Okay, why don't we sit down again? Okay. The congregation may be seated.
Yeah. One last thing. That feedback you hear is from a BlackBerry. If you've got a BlackBerry, it messes with these microphones, so please turn it off.
It's going off. All right. Also, the pilot loses navigation skills. Okay, first of all, I should explain who I am. My name is Christopher DeWeese. I'm from University of California, Davis. I'm part of the Sea Grant Extension Program. I'm not a member of the California Department of Fish and Game. Okay. Right. No. our role is basically to be doing marine research, applied marine research, and outreach and education, and basically we often are in the role of being the honest broker when issues come up, and we can be in that role. And what I want to do tonight is basically just give you some ideas on some of the alternatives. Jeremy has presented to you some of the primary management alternatives. I'm not going to recommend any management alternatives. It's not my position. First of all, there are about 40 people here, and I believe that there probably are 40 different concepts of how this fishery should be managed. And my challenge to you, and that's a lot of what I think tomorrow's about, is to begin to approach some sort of agreement or compromise about how you want to manage this fishery or how this fishery should be managed. And that's a really big challenge. Because first of all, I think that the first step in all of this to make designing management, if there is going to be a fishery, to make things work and design things well, is for you to vision what you want and decide on that as a community, as a the community interested in abalone, whether you're recreational, commercial, environmentally oriented, the state interested in conserving the resource and managing a fishery. It's your responsibility to come up with that. And once you can come up with this sort of some visions or alternatives that you want to really seriously look at, then it's a lot easier to design them because you know what your goals are. You need to have some goals of what you want. And that is the hardest part of the whole process. I mean, Jeremy has presented some ideas. There are other ideas out there among you guys that can be melded into a management plan for this fishery if it starts up again. So I just wanted to make a few recommendations about how you might approach this and what some of the alternatives are. Actually, Jeremy was talking about Garrett Hardin and the tragedy of the cons, but actually it was an economist who came up with the concept in fisheries. Before that, it was H. Scott Gordon back in the 50s, well ahead of the ecologists in some ways, who came up with a plan of how you would do fisheries with basically property rights to slow down the race for fishing, which is basically the problem in the commons where no one really has dedicated access to the, in your case, the shellfish, because what you've had is basically a race for shellfish. And there are a couple of ways to approach this. Of course, limited entry is one way. I mean, you could take the two basic approaches. You could take an approach where you have, like you did before, limited entry or some sort of access privilege that limits who can go out there and fish and leave it as competitive, the great American way of being competitive. That hasn't worked too well to date. And so I think you're going to have to look at some sort of dedicated access privilege. I'm not saying rights, but privileges, which gives some exclusivity and slows down that race for the resource because you need to look at that. And these sort of rights have been used around the world in lots of different ways, and privileges have been given in lots of different sort of techniques. It can be done spatially, such as the TURF idea, the territorial user right, where you are you assign to a group or organization or individuals or whatever the rights to basically harvest or the privilege to harvest and in many cases manage a distinct territorial area. Think of kelp beds and some of the ideas that the urchin fleet is looking at now, and many of you have been participants in the urchin fishery. And San Diego Group is starting to look at whether they would form a harvesting co-op and co-manage, do a stock assessment themselves in cooperation and collaboration with the state, and then manage, be basically involved in a co-management experiment with the state. So that's one approach, is to do it spatially, to allocate things spatially. Another is to allocate it to individuals, and was mentioned individual transferable quotas or individual quotas. This is where you take a percentage of the TAC, a proportion of the TAC, and it's allocated to individuals or organizations, whether they be commercial or recreational. Communities, there are all sorts of ways around the world it's been done in Alaska, Iceland, Canada, and in the U.S. So there's a whole range of ways to have these dedicated access privileges. And once, as Jeremy pointed out, once you have these dedicated access privileges, you have that exclusive privilege, but in return, your responsibility as a citizen, not allowing me to go out there and get that, is to pay the costs of managing the resource in that area. And that has been the general pattern. I mean, taxpayers are not going to want to pay for your exclusive access to something. So that has to be put into your mindset. And the incentives that come with dedicated access privileges change behavior. A lot of my research has been on how it changes participant behavior, and there are definite differences in behavior. That's not to say that these things are panaceas, these different types of dedicated access privileges. There are lots of issues that come up. Basically, I mean, I'm not going to talk about the biological issues where you're setting TACs and doing population assessment, but things like who receives allocations, how do they receive it? Is it auctioned off? Is it given based on catch histories? Is there some other formula? How much, you know, who can receive these privileges? Who is the state going to deal with in this? How much will people receive? How much will each, what will be the aggregation limit of a privilege? I mean, could three people aggregate all of it? When you look at some places in the world, you have very high aggregation limits where you might have three or four or five companies or organizations controlling most of the privileges. Other areas, it might be 500 individuals or organizations that have access. So that's something that you and the state need to come to grips with if you're going to go down this sort of path. Other issues are how you pay for it, how you do the research to maintain some knowledge of the stock, because it's key. All these dedicated access privileges, it's key to have a total allowable catch, because none of them really work well unless you have that sort of understanding of what you could take out of there each year. Jeremy talked about size limits, and I'm not going to talk about that sort of thing. I'm more interested in sort of the human dimension, human behavior side of this, and I think that's really what hangs up a lot of management, is how to implement something that changes your behavior. It's kind of like brain surgery, you know. It's like it's so delicate, and of course, you guys have seen it over the years, recent years, with the MPA stuff going on and management issues. So you're very, very sensitized to that. Here you have a sort of a split recreational commercial fishery, and I think my experience looking at other places in the world is, you're much better off if you can settle how you want to handle that before you go into any sort of long-term access privilege type programs. Because other places in the world who have gone into these programs and who have not settled these shared fishery concepts at the beginning have spent inordinate amounts of time, effort, money, grief, and yelling at trying to get through this. I mean, New Zealand's pushed up there as a model of sustainable fisheries, and but they are still, after 20 years, wrestling with a shared fishery in snapper fishery, abalone to some degree, lobster, rock lobster. They just still have not come to grips on how to do those allocations between groups, how to integrate recreational fishery into a dedicated access program, but if you put your mind to it, I think there are some ways to look at that. You know, either by having discussions and agreements on allocations, or having some sort of organization representing recreational people running the access privileges through an organization. There's just a wide range of thoughts, and I'm sure you guys all have a wide range of ideas on where to go with this sort of stuff. So that's primarily what I had, was that there are a couple of things you might want to consider. One is anything you do, you might want to think about doing it for a year or two or 5 years or whatever on an experimental, non-permanent basis so that you could learn, see what the unanticipated consequences are and make adjustments to whatever happens rather than putting it firmly into place right from the start and having people make career or life decisions, business decisions, based on what they think the plan will be forever. Other places in the world have started down those paths and then had to make major adjustments, and it's caused a lot of disruption. So you might want to have like a probationary period where you look at how things work. I mean, you have an opportunity to, if the resource is determined to be able to sustain a fishery, or to build something from the ground up and learn from past mistakes and apply some new ideas to it and come out with something that may be a real model for how you could go. So I think it's going to be really hard. You guys already know that. And I think it's up to you in the next day to start constructive discussions on how you might go about this in a successful way. Okay?
So I think all of that gives us a really nice basis to start our discussions. And we've got about 45 minutes now where we can give you all some time to ask some burning questions that you've had. But we do want to focus the discussion a bit on what it is we're trying to do over the next couple days here. And on the agenda, the topics for the panel discussion were to think about potential population models. You've heard some of those. Jeremy gave you an idea of one way you might sort of from the seat of your pants assess a population. Another question that had been brought up that people wanted to talk about tonight was how might you compare this one-time snapshot to some of the historical data we have from the department and other sources. Other management strategy examples, you've just gotten a few from both Chris and Jeremy, but people in the audience might have other things they want to float around tonight. And then what about patchiness, which is something that we've touched on in terms of how abalone grow and how they move and reproduce, but not directly looking at how might you protect breeding clusters to ensure you don't go to such a low level of density that breeding failure occurs. And then also we want to think about what we're trying to achieve tomorrow, because all of the discussion tonight is really leading into where we will start tomorrow to have some much more focused discussions in three breakout groups talking about the same thing each. So first, how can we use the snapshot data? And this would be a variety of things, and you can look on the agenda for tomorrow to see some of the questions we're asking. But also, how would you develop a total allowable catch? What are the steps that we need to take to think about a total allowable catch if there is a fishery at San Miguel? And then what other factors might we consider? You know, depth refuge, the existing marine protected areas, disease, natural events that change things. And then finally, monitoring beyond the first snapshot. If there is to be a fishery at any time, whether we start one now or later, continued monitoring is necessary. And we need to think about how is that going to happen? Do we do a snapshot every year? Though I think it was fun. I don't know if I want to try. But how might we do that? So I'll open the floor to questions of the panelists primarily. And see where we can get tonight. Start right there. And I think these mics work. You have to make sure the little light turns on, and then you can talk.
Okay, my question is for Dr. Prince. And my question is, I'm sure you use some assumptions in recruitment rate when you decide how many animals can be taken out of the resource. Now, would the recruitment rates for the, I guess they're black-lipped in Australia, would they be more often or more consistent possibly than what we have here? Because we know that they're very spotty here and can be long-term, hopefully not as long as the gooey duck.
I don't know that we should assume that the recruitment rates or function is terribly, or frequency is terribly different between the species. In the one fishery we have where the stock trend probably mirrors your own, we certainly see that being very variable as well, and El Nino driven as well. I believe that variability becomes a problem when you're holding your breeding biomass way too low. So, you know, effectively they're only getting a, because they're such low fecundity animals, they're effectively only getting a part of one breeding year in. And that these animals probably need about 10 year classes in their breeding biomass. And so that's why I would make my recommendations about size limits, that we should be keeping at least 50% of the potential breeding stock locked up on the bottom with our size limits. But then that, when you're moving over an extensive fishery, means a whole range of fine-scale size limits.
In the back.
Thank you.
Turn on the... Yeah, there you go.
Thank Great. You. My name is Don Thompson. I'm a former commercial abalone diver. I just wanted to make a comment in regards to the biomass estimate that we saw by Dr. Prince, and I just wanted to make a point that, you know, one of the things that I had a real issue with at the time the fishery was closed was that there wasn't a biomass estimate to base a decision on. And I'd like to just point out that at the time, we used the department's data on size frequency and base times the number of pounds of abalones harvested, and we came up with an estimate of about 2 million abalones based on the size frequency and how much was being harvested. So I think Dr. Prince's number of 1 million abalones at the island, to me, that's a good corroboration of, you know, an accurate estimate or a conservative estimate of what's out there. I think that if you took the two and you combined different types of analysis and data, you could have a higher level of comfort with using those numbers to make some sort of a decision. Thank you.
Is there a question in that, Don, or would you just wanted to make that?
It was just an
okay, great.
To support some of the data that you
saw. Okay, at the far end, yeah.
I'm hoping that the workshop can focus a little bit on recovery of the abalone population overall in Southern California, and not just look at San Miguel Island, because if the abalone larvae aren't moving great distances, then I'm left wondering, so how are we going to recover abalone elsewhere, and is there a role that the San Miguel population could play in that, and is that one of the decisions that, you know, if we're talking about moving shorts or something like that, is that something else that we could use this healthy population for to jumpstart recovery elsewhere?
Anybody, you have a comment on that? No? either of you? It's a curious question that comes up a lot, and with regards to what is the value of San Miguel to the other islands and the rest of Southern California.
Yeah? Some comment. You know, obviously I'm a proponent of using adult stocks, translocating adult stocks to spark recoveries where you really have a complete local extinction. I think we should be very, very cautious about translocating these things too far. I think that the evidence is that there's basically, while they're actually quite genetically uniform, there are basically the differences in them is proportional to distance. I think one of the options for our disease outbreak is that it's actually an Australian disease. It's just by moving the abalone between zones has been put into a naive population. I think you have to really take that situation as a really strong potential. So that I don't think you want to use a place like San Miguel as the brood source for the rest of your coastline. I think you want to be thinking about short hops. I also think we have the evidence in the data that, you know, the comment was made that, forget me, was it the northwest corner or the northeast corner had a markedly smaller size structure? Northwest. So there's an indication of the variation already in San Miguel. So you do have shorty patches, well, that's a very loose term. But so you do have sources there of, and you may want to think about, you know, establishing a beachhead on another island. But I think you need some experimentation first. You know, are these things going to be as immune to withering foot syndrome when you start bringing them back down the coastline? So I think there's some real issues there. I think there is potential to use San Miguel, but I don't think you want to think about it in a grand way. I think you want to proceed step by step and stay close.
Two questions. One about the extrapolation for total population around San Miguel. I think it was mentioned that an expansion shouldn't be based on area alone, but should be based on the habitat typing and density measurements that were made. And my guess is that if it's done well, it's going to end up with a lot lower number than the rule of thumb number that was, or the just a straight multiplication number. So I'd like to see that done. And then the second question was, it was mentioned that there was a 58% infection rate with withering foot syndrome, 12% intense, but no evidence of actual expression of pathological symptoms in these animals. My question is, does anyone know what that temperature threshold is where symptoms then start to be expressed, and with whether it's global warming or just the next El Nino, whether the red abs that are in those populations might run a risk of reaching that threshold where we might see higher rates of actual disease expression in that population, and therefore what cushion or precautionary factor might we have to consider just in case that happens?
Do you know that, Laura, what the temperature threshold? I know they've done some studies on temperature threshold. I don't know a specific number.
Yeah.
You try and use a mic. So send a mic her way.
Carolyn Friedman and Jim Moore have been doing a lot of work on temperature thresholds and what the temperature triggers are for the expression of WS in a lot of the different species, including reds. Looks like the temperature thresholds are on the order of 17, 18 degrees. These are temperatures that San Miguel sees during El Nino events.
Questions, thoughts, Con? Yeah, grab a mic and push the little button. There you go.
Well, I first want to thank the department people and the other groups, including the CAA, for having conducted the survey. I think we have one of the best pictures. We've had a snapshot of where stocks are. I want to thank you all for going in that direction. I also have a couple of questions. I really would like to hear from most of these other people because we'll have plenty of opportunity to talk about this, being involved in this issue. But Jeremy, I think there's one thing that I can't let rest. you used the word recovery very loosely. And forgive me, because in terms of Australia, I can understand that. However, and you said some really great things that I really totally agree with. You understand serial depletion. You also understand that recruitment can be very infrequent. This is a wonderful thing that we understand about these abalone, that they, just like rockfish, they live for many, many years and keep reproducing, so that serendipitous event oceanographically allows that recruitment to occur. And clearly that's an issue, but I think the recovery issue kind of leads me to, you know, you're talking about Labigata, the Australian species, right? Okay. Okay, right. But I think that really wasn't discussed very much tonight was the recruitment failure. Shepherd and Brown and others, interestingly enough, when they talk about Labigata, I mean, and you can confirm this or not, I mean, when they get down to densities that we're seeing here off Miguel, based on the survey, this wonderful survey, we have recruitment failure. I mean, that's for levigata, not for rufescence, of course. But we're using the same model when we talk about short beds and all that other stuff. You see that as a potential threat to, because this is circular to this question about recovery, because you're describing recovery over 10 years. There's no evidence that I see in the data that you wonderfully collected here that any recovery has occurred. In real terms, in terms of recruitment, you have, and also the other thing that I noticed about your data set, we haven't had a chance to analyze it yet, but those densities haven't been weighted by abundance, by location. This is very preliminary, isn't it?
Yeah, I'll accept that it's very preliminary, highly speculative. I'm used to working in situations and making recommendations to divers about particular reefs where we actually have a lot less data than that. Our own proof before our own eyes is that it's much better to do that and move the situation forward than to sit back and say, let's wait and have perfect data before we do anything. So that's really the spirit I was offering it in. In fact, compared to a lot of those situations I'm in, we have a very, very blessed with data here. But I'll accept, absolutely the comments that the previous one as well, that that's a very speculative analysis to do, and that the final fully analysed data will look quite differently. I won't go as far as to say that, be confident that it'll be lower when you've done the proper job. That's certainly a possibility. So that's sort of the first issue. The issue of density and recruitment collapse, I noticed that you people are using animals per hectare. I'd very much... You're using egg production per square metre type values? The figures I've seen in the documentation is talking about this number of 1,200 per hectare, and I note the very different size of the animals, and so I'd like to know more about the comparative for countries.
The only reason we started with that number historically, because the densities were so low in Southern California, there was no way to count them per metre squared.
Hectare or whatever. But the point I'm getting at is, are we talking numbers per unit area or egg production per unit area? And you seem to be comparing a number of animals taken out for levigata, which is a much smaller animal, and without the data, I would just presume has a much lower fecundity. So if we're talking about actual spawning per recruit or eggs laid down per area, that's the basis I think we should get back to discussing.
No, I was actually asking you about aggregation, and actually we should be talking about aggregation of adults, because they have to be within a meter of each other to spawn.
Yeah, and that's where, in this issue of how we deal with patchiness, the way we're dealing with patchiness is to have these conservative size limits which are matched to the size structure of the actual aggregations. So, we're really just skimming the top off of these patches. What I'm saying to these divers is that on an annual rate of harvest, we should be leaving about 70% of the animals in place. That they shouldn't be... They should have to leave the bulk of the population there. This what's been the general practice of these industries right around the world is everything in front of you, you take. And, we know where that leads us. And we have to reverse that entirely to where the patch structure... Our size limits are so well matched to the fine scale structure of these populations that every population is left intact after harvesting.
Saki, yeah.
I had a quick question for the two of you from the social side of it, kind of from where I'm going to leave the science to the hardcore abalone biologist. I'm more curious in the social experiment or issues, which is in your examples in Tasmania, it wasn't clear to me how the recreational and commercial sectors partition those areas. Are they exclusive use? Are they overlapped? I couldn't tell from your presentation.
It worked my strategy then. This is a really, really difficult issue in Australia as well. From what I can pick up here, it doesn't look that dissimilar. It's probably Western Australia is leading the pack in this, where they're going, and it's not just in abalone, they're going down the track of explicitly allocating catch to each of the sectors in every fishery. They are also deciding that some fisheries are recreational alone fisheries, and they're buying out commercial industries so they can be entirely recreational industries. They, within terms of abalone, probably this issue is most advanced on the roe abalone, which is a small species that lives up in the intertidal zone and in front of the Perth, city of Perth, which is my hometown. There is a commercial, there is a roe. This is a city of getting towards be 1.5 million people. And particularly since the end of the Vietnam War, we had a big influx of Vietnamese people. It's become very, very popular. Now the commercial industry is excluded from the metropolitan beaches, and we've extended the definition of metropolitan to include a number of other coastal smaller towns. And in those areas, the fishery is down to, they're doing annual surveys of these recreational stocks. There's no such surveys for the commercial stocks, but they're doing annual surveys of the recreational stocks. And that fishery is down to being, it's just closed, it's down to being 4 Sunday mornings for 1 hour each year. And it's getting shorter every year.
On a follow-up, I don't think I completely understood or got an answer to your examples of the, I forgot what section of the coast where the commercial fishermen are doing their monitoring. Are those areas only open to commercial take?
No, those areas, basically everywhere else in Australia and New Zealand, the recreational fishery is allowed in the same areas, or the commercial fishery land, same whichever way you put it, they're allowed in the same areas together. Just to finish off, in Victoria they've actually, following the West Australian model, they haven't yet spatially separated the commercial and recreational sectors, but they're following the same approach of shorter and shorter seasons. So around the city of Melbourne, which is a city of 3 million, they are down to, this figure will be wrong, but it'll indicate the relative magnitude towards the West Australian situation. They're down to their fishery is something like 8 weekends during summer you're allowed to take abalone if you're recreational. But everywhere apart from that West Australian situation, the recreationals and the commercial people are in the same areas. In every situation, there is the same size limit being applied, apart from where this fine-scale process is going on of management. Then there, the commercial divers are lobbying the government to get higher size limits, and they're, because they recognise it's a bigger fight than they want, they're not pushing that upon the recreational guys. And they're not only pushing the commercial size limits up, but they're also having voluntary size limits, which are higher than that in some places as well.
Can I ask a follow-up? I don't want to hog all this. I'm intensely curious about this issue. So if the commercial fishermen are being assigned these territorial access privileges, and
we haven't got that far yet.
Oh, okay. Never mind. I'll stop. Because I was going to ask, how do they are responsible and have a sporty come in? And
there's starting to be a lot of intense conversation on this issue, and that's one of the major issues. And I'd suggest eventually it has to go to having recreational fisheries distinct from commercial fisheries. It turns out in the wild fishery, generally the divers move away from recreational impact anyway.
Okay, we got one here, and then I'm going to go across the room again.
Can I add one comment. What we're seeing in many places now with dedicated access privileges around the world is that when the TAC is determined, then an allocation is made first to say First Nation obligations, traditional ceremonial fisheries, and recreational off the top in many, many fisheries. And then the remainder is a TACC, a total allowable commercial catch. So you make an allocation like that. And then they're struggling with how to allocate there. I mean, New Zealand has looked at angler clubs or organizations. You could look at licenses or whatever.
Okay. There, and then I'm going to swap the room.
Thank you. I just have a question. Actually, I'm not certain if I'll put this essentially to the panel, but to some of the survey participants and those interpreting the data. It appears to me that kelp canopy, kelp cover, is being used as a surrogate for appropriate or suitable abalone habitat. Yet in the northwest zone, admittedly, there were fewer numbers of transects run in the survey, yet they showed some of the lowest abalone densities among the entire survey. So I'm wondering, is there some consistent and objectively applicable standard for habitat description that can be relied upon for extrapolating densities from the transects to larger regions other than kelp canopy?
I'll cover it and then tell me if I need more, Pat. One of the things we haven't analyzed yet is the habitat data, and that will be critical to determining perhaps why these differences are occurring, because clearly kelp canopy lies over a whole variety of bottoms.
True.
And so, yes, we do need to look at the habitat data that we did collect, and it just hasn't been analyzed yet. So that's for the next step, that's the next thing to do, definitely.
Okay. So just briefly as a follow-up then, any estimates upon abundance at this time that are extrapolated from the survey data towards total zonal abundance based upon the habitat assumptions of kelp canopy are not...
their estimates.
Thank you.
Yeah. Next.
Yes. It's unfortunate that Pedro Sierra is not here to relate what is happening in Mexico and what they've been doing. They do have territorial user rights. The cooperativos have concessions. They manage their fishery in cooperation with the INP, the fisheries agency. And they do surveys on half-kilometer by half-kilometer grids and assign quotas to each of those grids, some of which receive no quotas, some of which have a very high quota. And their maximum fishing mortality rate is F.05, and they generally choose to go below that to rebuild their stocks.
Sorry, hold on one second. 0.05?
Yes.
Okay, thanks.
That's their maximum.
And one thing, we do want to bring Pedro here soon. Yeah. Just got to get him a visa. Next.
I make personal diagnosis.
Oh, can we grab a microphone for him? Thanks.
My name is Jeff Baldwin. I've been a commercial diver since the early 70s, and I saw a major fall in our stocks when the sporting industry went out of sight. I've heard estimates of 40,000 possibly sport divers picking abalone today, but I wanted this question is for Jeremy Prince. I was just wondering, an average sport diver handling abalone, not, and I'm talking about the weekend warrior, not the guys that are really serious and conservative, but the weekend guy that goes out there handling abalone, trying to find a 7-inch abalone, prying 5-inch abalones off the rocks, that's when I saw the decline here. In your opinion, do you think that's one of the reasons why our fisheries collapsed? That it was just the user group was rehandling abalone over and over and over again?
I don't want to attribute that behavior to any one sector. Certainly I see the commercial sector in New Zealand, which let's note is a free dive fishery, so your handling on the bottom is definitely not the best. But I think allowing a fishery to be managed at such high exploitation levels that you're picking things right on the measure is a recipe for disaster, regardless of who's doing it. These things don't handle well. You don't want people sorting shell. You know, it's a fact of these fisheries that the areas that go down first are the areas with big abalone, you know, because they are the most desirable areas, are the areas least protected by size limits. So what you're left with in a fishery are the shorty patches where the size limit was actually protecting enough breeding stock to sustain the stock. So if you don't manage your spatial element well, if you don't manage your exploitation rate well, so that people are picking over abalone, trying to find a few sized in amongst a whole lot of undersized, it's just a recipe for disaster, whoever's doing it.
one more question. It's in my opinion that if we could implement when this fishery goes into effect at San Miguel Island, that the sportsmen have to take an abalone handling course. I think it's most important that people realize that a little slip of the iron, they're cut, they're gone. You can't trade up. If you've picked an abalone off the rock, it's your abalone. That's it. Get out of the water. So I would love to see some kind of abalone handling course mandatory for everybody to take. Thank you.
Okay. I'd stress the everybody outside the recreational industry as well. I mean everybody.
Can I go to the back? I missed you.
John, actually this is sort of directed to you and Jeremy, and it's a question that somebody asked earlier. And it's regarding maybe tomorrow during the workshop that people address the issue of if there is take allowed on San Miguel Island, what will those impacts be in the recovery of areas outside of San Miguel? And not so much with regards to transplanting those animals like Jeremy you touched on and the potential for disease and the fact that that may not work over long distance. But if you're taking 10% or 5% or what have you out of the existing population on San Miguel, how will that decrease, if at all, the recovery rate outside of San Miguel and what those impacts might be? It just should be addressed.
So we'll keep that as, I think that's been raised, and I think people should think about that one tomorrow. Was there one in front? Yeah, can we grab him a mic or lean back?
Dr. Jeremy, you said on the in over New Zealand they're free diving. Is that both for the commercial and the recreational sector? And why?
That is for both sectors. The why is probably history. There is some suggestion that iris is quite a shallow water abalone, not as shallow as roe. Most of its habitat is within 10 metres. In some very rare places, it will go down to as deep as 20 metres, but that's really, you can ignore that. 10 metres basically pulls it up, but the water's quite dirty and quite cold. And there is some evidence that the slowly over life, they shuffle their way out to depth, depth being 15 foot, 5 metres or so. Yeah, well, no, shallower than 10 metres. So historically they didn't, historically the catch was controlled through the companies in export by export permits for the companies, and they didn't control the number of divers. So it seemed logical for them at the time to limit the efficiency of the divers, seeing they weren't controlling the number of divers. And I mean, I wasn't there debating these topics. This is decisions made in the 60s. But that's, as I understand it, how, through history it came about. There's quite intense debate now about that measure, with a lot of us divers arguing that until the big companies accept that the resource is not in a good state and until they get the catch levels and size limits sorted out, that we shouldn't be improving efficiency. The big companies who very much control that system and own most of the quota, rather than face up to what's going on with the resource, basically just want to increase the efficiency of divers with compressed air. And so, but there is quite some, people accepting that, theoretically at least, if you have ITQ and a range of other measures, you don't really need that anymore. But and certainly would improve the way the abalone are handled. But it's a complex situation.
Question on harvest size. A lot of fishery research for many, many different species has shown that artificial selection is extremely powerful. For example, salmon. If you fish and are only allowed to take the big ones, in a few generations, you're selecting for adults that never get big. And so the question becomes, perhaps in some instances, these shorty patches may not just be because of the habitat and the conditions, but is it possible that artificial selection would have led them to that? And so to avoid this artificial selection problem, a couple options might be either a slot limit, so there's a reward for getting big and not just punishment, and or the use of marine reserves, of course, would help reduce the pressure of artificial selection towards smaller adults. So I was just wondering if you had any thoughts about size limits resulting in selection towards smaller adults over several generations.
I certainly believe it's a possibility. The main effect of fishing and not fishing that we actually observed, we haven't documented it well, has actually been density-dependent effects changing growth. So that we've seen shorty patches that were very, very dense improving growth as they were thinned, and we've seen growth patterns slow down and as densities build back up. So that seems to be a very strong and common effect across a range of species. In terms of a slot, we have quite a lot of talk about that, and I'm actually a big proponent on a range of long-lived species of having a slot. Until we sort out the spatial complexity, though, a slot doesn't achieve what you think it achieves in abalone. It just changes where the pressure goes and changes the beds that get overexploited. And generally what we have left in most of the fisheries are our shorty patches, and we don't have those big beds left anymore. So if we just put a slot in now, we would just finish off our process of serial depletion. But the day I can have a TURF, a territorial user right, and match my fishing pattern to the nature of the abalone rock by rock, then I'll be using rock by rock a slot.
Yeah, and then back. Sorry, I keep pointing there and not getting you.
Thanks, Don. Thank you, Don Thompson again. Just a question for Dr. Prince. A lot of the focus over the last 10 years in our fishery has been trying to determine what's a good density. And I think that's where really the spotlight's been shining, is if there's a number that is a safe number where the populations sustain themselves. And I think some of the department staff touched on that a little bit earlier in regards to what the densities are, and whether the populations might be at some risk of some further decline in the future. Another concept was mentioned, but it hasn't really been touched on or discussed a lot, and that's this patchiness. Because obviously you could have two abalone a couple inches apart from each other, and you have a high density if you're only measuring 1 meter of area versus measuring hectares or kilometers or larger areas because of the aggregations of those animals. And I think, you know, right now we've, in this country, we've been discussing a lot where to draw that line, where to put the density measure. Is that even the right measure to be using to protect the populations, or maybe you could just elaborate a little bit on that?
That paper by Shepherd and Brown that Con referred to earlier on, that sort of puts the density forward, was a good step in advancing the argument, but inevitably these things are oversimplifications, and I have some difficulty with it in sticking to a single density. What we actually observe is a very great range of bottom that the diving community talks about as one extreme we have good recovery bottom and the other extreme we have non-recovery bottom. And the non-recovery bottom is stuff that didn't sustain fishing, and the non-recovery bottom is stuff that constantly amazes its ability to come back. And I'd suggest that the difference between the types of bottom is very large. It's partly a function of how much of the breeding stock, the size limit forced you to leave behind, but it's very much a function as well of the complexity of the bottom and how current swept the bottom is. So that area, bottom that's very, very complex and has good potential to hold the larvae
seems to be much more productive. But what I'm getting at there is that there is actually in the wild going to be a great range of densities which are required, and it's going to be very site-specific. And there, sticking with any single number is very dangerous. That being said, you know, this is an animal that species by species, with the exception of some of these small cryptic species, all the commercial species have evolved to make these dense aggregations. And so we have to expect that they're doing that for a reason, and the reason is to maximise or optimise the fertilisation of eggs and sperm. So these animals that do have to have high densities, even though it's going to be a variable density. And I would rather come at the issue not in a single number of density, but by I'd use the concept of spawning per recruit. You know, this is a concept analogous to yield per recruit, that if you think about it, you can, if you know the basic life parameters for an area, you can calculate what their potential egg production is through their life. And I think regardless of the size structure or the density, we should be aiming to leave a large amount of that potential there. I'd be suggesting at least 50%. So I tend to come at it, gets us to much the same place about preserving high densities and not allowing patches to be broken up. But again, I'd stress this needs to be spatially explicit. One size isn't going to fit all, but generally we need to be thinking of leaving and creating high density patches in all our areas.
Okay, now the one that I keep missing.
Yeah, this is for Jeremy. What is the shortest frequency that you've seen a reevaluation of the resource? And that's half the question. The other half is, what would you recommend if there was a plan for working to reevaluate the information? I mean, would you be... What I understood you to say is that the divers are accumulating the information as they're going along in a logbook or not. I didn't understand that part of it, but in our recovery plan, that was part of what we were getting at, is that you were going to have daily logs or some kind of a logging thing to keep sort of a track of it. But just, I'd just like to know if any of the ones that you've seen or set up, if what the frequency is, and then what you would recommend.
I think the technique, I mean, I think just recording good old-fashioned catch and effort in a logbook is not going to cut it. You know, all the fisheries have found that there are, it's particularly the way the divers don't have to search. They know, they remember the patches and they can visually check out a patch and keep swimming. It means that catch rates as a catch per diver out is always going to be hyper-stable. Too stable, it's not going to reflect declines. The measure I would use is actually, I indicated before, it would be kilos per distance swum. Now, we're starting to, in Tasmania, there's a guy called Craig Mundy, who's progressing a technique which is a very small GPS unit in the front of the boat, and you can actually record detailed swim patterns of divers, and you can then start putting kilos per metre swum. And then there you start seeing real trends. We go one step further in Victoria in some of the zones where we also connect that data up to a logger, where, and they use that to size the abalone. So there's a GPS position and size of every abalone caught. And together those two, I think, will basically give you, you know, what the Craig Mundy, who's, we're using this mainly to document reef structure and where the different size abalone are, because we're focused on fine scale size limits and catch. In Tasmania, they're trying to, and we're working from the bottom-up process. In Tasmania, they're still trying to work with a top-down process where this data goes to the government and they try and control everything. So they're still thinking about the more orthodox stock assessment. So they're talking about using this distance covered per kilo as an indicator. I've gone and lost the point I was working to.
How often?
I think you need to be going that way. If the other way I'd go would be actually, and this is a suggestion I was making to the urchin industry, that they at the beginning or as part of every day, they actually do some way of measuring some sort of random or some sort of systematic number of abalone per area. You know, we have to go beyond the old-fashioned just catch and effort. It really doesn't give us enough information. But I think with new technologies, there's starting to be some really exciting possibilities there of collecting much more structured data. That's what I was getting to with Craig Mundy. He's not only with that data aiming to track catch rates in terms of catch per distant swum, but also trying to keep track on patches disappearing from being fished anymore. So trying to get at the documentation on a very, very fine scale, GPS scales, of whether all areas are staying in use. Personally, I'd prefer to be coming from a bottom-up approach, but we can basically, with the data we're collecting, we have size data as well, and we can do all the analyses that Craig is developing.
Okay, and that takes us to the end of the night. We've got one last desperate question.
This is for Jeremy. Poaching in Australia was rather famous, and I believe there was one guy that was running across the Bass Strait and had numerous boats at his disposal. Who pays for the enforcement in Australia? Do the fishermen pay for it, or does the general taxpayer pay for it?
The fishermen. Our fisheries are all revenue neutral to the taxpayer. They're all user pays.
Okay. So tomorrow, for the AAG members, your meeting starts at 8 a.m. It's upstairs in this building. I will try and provide some coffee in the morning so we can get you jump-started. For the rest of you folks, if you're interested in participating in the breakout groups, we will begin promptly at 9 with the breakout groups, and we'll have a little discussion in that same room upstairs before that. Think about what we've talked about tonight. Look at the agenda, because it does include sort of the topics we'd like to get your input on, and we'll see you tomorrow.